From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org. WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. After more than 3 days of counting and recounting, it was clear by midday Thursday that Felipe Calderon had won Mexico's presidential election. The conservative had apparently squeaked out his victory over left-leaning Andrés Manuel López Obrador by little more than half a percentage point. But López Obrador refused to concede defeat and promised to bring his charge of voting irregularities to a special electoral court. Meanwhile, north of the border, the media felt a distinct sense of déjà vu.
In Mexico tonight, it is beginning to look a lot like Florida back in the year 2000. 4 days now.
Say after this is reminiscent of the contest between George W. Bush and Al Gore 6 years ago.
Count Mexico's version of the 2000 Bush versus Gore election here.
In scenes reminiscent of the 2000 Florida recount.
Dan Gretsch has been covering the Mexican election for American Public Media's Marketplace, and he also experienced that been-there-done-that feeling.
I was working for the Miami Herald back in 2000, and I was part of its coverage of the election, and I was in the newsroom, like everybody else, glued to the television. And I remember that TV started broadcasting who had won Florida before the polls had even closed in the Panhandle, which is on Central Time. And I remember they announced Florida for Gore, then for Bush, and eventually nobody.
And in fact, while the similarities in the tight race are obvious, there are differences between Florida 2000 and Mexico 2006, and that is substantially the way the media covered it. The Mexican media, I gather, were a lot more circumspect. Can you give us a blow-by-blow of how election night and the aftermath played out?
Well, one of the things that you need to know about the Mexican media is there was a media blackout from Wednesday at midnight to 8 p.m. Sunday, which is the time when the last poll closed in Tijuana. I've even been told that the law says that anyone who does propagate a poll during that blackout period is subject to up to 3 years in prison. So no one was really touching it. In fact, Fox News cut their local broadcast rather than risk defying this particular law. So 8 p.m. comes, and everyone's sort of on the edge of their seats because we're all waiting finally after days and days of not having any idea what's going to happen to finally hear the results. And the entity that gets the first word in this is Mexico's Electoral Institute. It's called the IFE. So at 8 p.m., they basically get on the air and they say, this race is too close to call. Check back with us in 3 hours.
Now, that's a stunner for a number of reasons, not the least of which, before the media blackout, according to all the polls, Obrador held a commanding lead, it seemed, over Calderon.
It was a huge surprise. And then what was an even bigger surprise, sort of from a journalistic standpoint, was that from 8 p.m. on, none of the other media outlets, none of the two major TV stations, none of the major newspapers elaborated on this. I know that they had all been doing their own exit polls, and none of them released these exit polls. And so for 3 hours, there was this silence. And it was so deafening that I ended up taking a nap during this time. I mean, it became clear to me at about 9 p.m. that A, I was in for a really long night, and B, I wasn't going to learn anything new until about 11 p.m., so I went and took a nap. At 11 p.m. that night, the Electoral Institute comes back on, and they basically say that the race is still too close to call. We're not going to declare a winner tonight.
Did it arouse suspicion about whether, you know, something was being hushed up or whether something unsavory was going on?
Absolutely, it did. And in the days following this deafening silence, there have been accusations thrown back and forth that the decision to not release the exit poll data by these news organizations was actually a political decision and not a journalistic one. And you can agree or disagree with this, but it definitely is a reflection of the way that the media is looked at here in Mexico.
I gather with some substantial measure of distrust.
That's exactly right. The Mexican media, and particularly Televisa, the leading television broadcaster here, has a long history of ties with the local government and with the PRI, the party that ran Mexico for 71 years. And in fact, there's a really famous or infamous story in Mexican journalism. Back in 1968, just a few days before the Summer Olympics were being held in Mexico City, there was a student demonstration and 300 students were massacred. And when it came to the nightly news that night, Televisa makes a brief mention that 30 people had been killed in clashes and then moves on to discussing the upcoming Olympic Games. And that's an incident that still is in people's minds down here.
From your perspective, do you believe that there are any vestiges of, you know, big media being in the pocket of the ruling party that had been such an issue for so long in Mexico?
If you had asked me this question this morning, I would have said this was a journalistic decision to not air these exit polls. They decided that the polling data was too close, that ultimately the independent electoral body, the IFE, was the one that should be releasing the poll data first and that they would follow them, and that therefore if the IFE wasn't releasing its data, then they wouldn't either. But then I started having conversations with some independent journalists down here and asking them this question, was this a political decision? And all of them said yes. And they said that this was a decision which basically reflects a lack of courage in the local media down here. And I said, well, what do you mean? And they say, this is an example of the local media taking the government line, publishing only the government's polls rather than their independent poll data.
Now, that would be a more compelling argument if the vote, as declared by the Electoral Commission, some way didn't match the exit poll data gathered by the networks. But in fact, they did match. It was a dead heat with a few hundred thousand votes out of 43 million separating the winner from the loser.
In the end, I think in the final analysis, I fall on the side of journalistic integrity. I think they knew that no matter what they did in this situation, their decision would be questioned by one side or another. And I think that they ultimately erred, so to speak, on the side of caution, precisely because they felt like this is a fragile and young democracy, and this is an independent electoral body that has been put together pretty scrupulously. Let them call this election.
All right, Dan. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dan Gratch covers Latin America for American Public Radio's Marketplace. He spoke to us on Thursday from Mexico City. Also on Thursday, we got in touch with Sergio Sarmiento, editorial board director for TV Azteca, one of Mexico's two big broadcasters. Sarmiento told us that not calling the election on election night was a no-brainer.
No pollster in the world would release the results of an exit poll that falls within the margin of error. In our case, the difference was 0.3 and our margin of error was 1.5. The point is that it is our pollsters, the mathematicians who actually control the polls, who tell us that they cannot predict a winner. We went on the air and we said our exit poll was too close to call and we would wait for the quick count that would give us more information later on that night. And we waited for that, but it was still too close to call. So we said all along that it was too close to call.
What you're saying to me makes perfect sense. However, some of Obrador's supporters have taken a slightly more paranoid view, and at least one local muckraking magazine called Proceso said that Interior Ministry officials in Vicente Fox's administration actually persuaded the networks to keep silent on the issue of exit poll results. Is there any truth to that report?
Well, Proceso, as everyone knows in Mexico, is a magazine that is very closely aligned with López Obrador, and they were clearly preparing the ground to be able to present a mobilization to contest the results of the election. They always said they were going to do that, so I'm not surprised.
Did you confer with any other news organizations and kind of put your heads together to decide what to do as it became clear that this race was so tight?
I had information of basically five or six organizations, both news and party organizations. We do that for the purpose of just making sure that we're, roughly on the right track. But every organization makes its own decision.
Now, under Mexican law, news organizations are not allowed to release public opinion polling in the week before an election. Considering that the challenger, Obrador, had at one point a very substantial lead that kept narrowing and narrowing, do you think the fact that the public was not aware of how much it was narrowing ended up creating a kind of shock on election night?
Yes. Most people who, at least I personally, who didn't have access to public opinion polls on the week before the election, assumed that López Obrador was going to win by 2 or 3 percentage points. And I think a lot of people did. And that happens when you don't have public opinion polls on the week before the election, which is when many of the undecided make up their minds.
So the blackout actually contributed to some confusion and frustration. After this is all over with, do you suppose that there will be a move for more transparency in the lead up to a vote?
I doubt it. On the coattails of the good result of López Obrador, the alliance of leftist parties that supported López Obrador actually had a very major increase in seats in Congress. And López Obrador's party has always blocked any liberalization of our public opinion poll legislation.
Calderon is the candidate of the National Action Party, which is the party of incumbent President Vicente Fox. National Action won the presidency from the PRI, the dominant political force in Mexico for decades. And PRI had a history of unscrupulousness in elections. Is TV Azteca doing anything to try to determine whether, in fact, National Action Party has followed in the footsteps of its predecessor, PRI, in fraudulent elections?
Well, the government doesn't organize the elections. It's an independent body that organizes the election. And certainly I haven't seen any indication that there was any rigging of the election. And of course, I'm open-minded about that or any other accusation, although I do usually want to see some evidence.
What can the media do in a case like this to act as watchdogs and sort of independently certify the results of the commission?
We cover every claim of irregularities. We try to look at the evidence. We have in our TVs and newspapers and radio shows members of all political parties. If there is any evidence of wrongdoing, we try to follow that evidence. And very often we are successful. In fact, I was one of the journalists who actually uncovered the so-called Pemex Gate scandal in the 2000 election, in which we discovered that the oil monopoly Pemex had actually given money illegally to the campaign of Francisco Labastida, the candidate of the PRI party. We do that as a matter of course. That's what we do.
Well, Sergio, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sergio Sarmiento is editorial board director for TV Azteca Television Network and a columnist for the Daily Reforma.
Coming up, a series of unsolved murders casts reporters as gumshoes in Juarez.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Whoever ultimately wins Mexico's presidency will inherit a growing problem, crime and corruption, particularly the crime associated with the drug cartels and the corruption that has hobbled the police. And few places are more symbolic of Mexico's inability to police itself than Juarez. A border town sustained by multinational factories that draw workers from across the country, Juarez has seen the kidnappings, rapes, and murders of some 400 girls and women since 1993. In the United States, we'd like to think that federal and local police would fall all over each other to solve such a high-profile case. But in Juarez, some believe police and prosecutors are bending over backwards not to solve it. In the absence of any discernible progress in the investigation, reporters often have taken the lead, as WNYC's Marianne McCune found when she brought us this report in 2003.
Even the mostly poor, uneducated mothers of those killed seem able to investigate more thoroughly than do local police. After 20-year-old Claudia Gonzalez's maimed body turned up alongside seven others, it was her mother, Josefina Gonzalez, who went back to where she was found to look for clues.
We found her pants in a bag under some bushes. And another day, we looked again and found her factory ID just lying there in the desert.
Across the border in El Paso, FBI Special Agent Art Wurge says that's just the kind of thing he would do.
Detect the problem until the problem is resolved. We set up a computerized system of following each and every lead. We assign the lead to agents.
Police in Juarez have made arrests. Several dozen people are in jail. But only one has been convicted, and the evidence against those charged is questionable at best. One former forensics investigator quit the Chihuahua State Police, saying he was pushed to plant evidence against a suspect. Art Wurge held training sessions this year for Mexican investigators, but he says he's most impressed by the investigative skills of local newspapers.
I've seen reports where they've actually diagrammed the areas the abduction is taking place, the dump site, the characteristics of the victims, what we call victimology. There's a lot of good leads.
We don't have a badge and a gun to go out and arrest anybody, but we can reveal, and then it's out there.
Diana Washington Valdez has been covering the case for years for the El Paso Times. She's written stories about investigations that were suppressed because they implicated wealthy and powerful men, and about police who were suspects in crimes against women yet never prosecuted. But such revelations have done frustratingly little to spur officials into action. So sometimes reporters are taking action themselves. One helped set up a rape crisis center. And Washington Valdez was among those who recently barged in on a nightclub she believes is involved in the murders based on a leaked FBI report. A media ambush, she called it. The group found the club's bathroom covered with pornographic photographs, and the club's layout and staff matched those described in the report, but they found nothing to confirm accusations. Still, Washington Valdez says they were able to alert Juarez residents of possible danger.
The time has come when we might have to increase the risk to ourselves in order to advance the issue.
Case in point, Samira Isaguirre, one of the hosts of a popular Juarez radio show.
Buenos días.
Buenos días, Samira.
Mande.
When at her previous station, she urged listeners to come to a candlelight vigil in hopes of pushing the government to solve the murders. She says thousands more than she expected crowded the streets.
El gobierno vio peligro.
The government saw danger. They thought I wanted to attack them politically.
Isaguirre and her co-hosts were abruptly fired a few weeks later. The station said the hosts owed money for past airtime, but Isaguirre believes Chihuahua state officials pressed the station to get rid of them. And now she's afraid of worse than losing her job. She says strange men have threatened her and her children, and many other journalists as well.
Yo sé que era mejor el día de mañana.
I know they could kill me tomorrow, but right now I just think there's no one else addressing the problem.
After one government suspect said police tortured a confession out of him, he died mysteriously in prison. State police officers admitted to killing the defense lawyer of another suspect. They say it was self-defense. Alfredo Quijano Hernandez's small local newspaper El Norte has investigated the case perhaps more aggressively than any. He flips proudly through 5 days of the paper's coverage after state police killed defense attorney Mario Escobedo.
We heard through the police radio that the attorney had had an accident. When we got there, there were about 200 police officers there.
Quijano says he took pictures of every car in sight. So when state police released a photo of a bullet hole in one of its cars, supposed evidence that the attorney shot first, Quijano published his own photo of the car that night, completely unscathed.
publicamos la información con lo que teníamos.
We published the information saying we believe it was an assassination, and that provoked a strong reaction from the government.
That afternoon, the reporter who wrote the story says he saw two big cars in his rearview mirror.
La Suburban se paró frente a mí.
One car got in front of me, and then the other, and they blocked my way. Then one man got out of his car, and I thought it was the end of me.
Carlos Huerta says they told him to stop with the kind of stories he'd been writing. He says he lied to them, told them he'd back down. Now he's still on the street, and they're still on the street, and so are the state police who shot defense attorney Escobedo. Despite El Norte's coverage, the government accepted the officer's claim that Escobedo shot first. Whether or not government officials are actually complicit in any of these crimes, Mexican media analyst Ernesto Villanueva says it's clear they're more interested in controlling public opinion than bringing the culprits to justice. Some mothers say they're urged not to talk to the press when they report their daughters missing. Officials in Chihuahua have even gone so far as to prosecute journalists for allegedly defaming them.
They try to buy the journalists, and if they can do it well, they try to destroy them.
Newspapers also bring in revenue with what are called casetillas, advertisements that look like news articles but are paid for by wealthy individuals. El Norte's competitor El Diario published claims radio host and activist Samira Isaguirre was a regular at strip clubs, not fit to be speaking for the mothers. Receipts showed the state government paid for the accusations, according to local reporters who followed up.
You think that it's information, but it's, in fact, it's an advertisement, and you paid for that. It's an enemy with the people's right to know. And we have two sides, the government that pay and the press that accept to do it.
The result is more than the average confusion about who's printing the truth and when. Some mothers of murdered girls and their advocates accuse El Diario and other local papers of taking orders from the governor or even the local drug cartel. But El Diario reporter and editor Martin Ortiz retorts El Norte is a mouthpiece for the mothers and activists.
No publicamos todo lo que ellos quieren. Cuando no lo
publicamos, we don't publish everything they want, and that bothers them. The easiest thing to do is accuse us of being with the governor or some political parties. El Diario is attacked all the time.
The powers that be may not succeed in efforts to intimidate individual reporters, but they do succeed in casting doubt in all directions. Media analyst Villanueva says two things need to happen before Juarez reporters can operate outside of politics.
We have to cut the economical ties between media and government.
And far more difficult, he says, fix a broken justice system so that reporters don't have to fill in the void. Still, many locals say if the Juarez mystery is ever solved, it will be because reporters have stretched the boundaries of their jobs. Local coverage has attracted international attention, and the murders are slowly becoming a worldwide human rights issue. Whether every detail reported is accurate may not matter. Any version of this story adds to the pressure on Mexico to act. For On the Media, I'm Marianne McCune in Mexico City.
In the 3 years since that piece first aired, the killings have continued, and so has the danger for journalists covering the story. But when it comes to entertainment, the tragedy in Juarez has provided fodder for songs, plays, telenovelas, and made-for-TV movies. Tinseltown, however, has never shown much interest until now. In two films slated for release this year, Minnie Driver and J-Lo tackled the case. Both play journalists, and at least one real journalist is concerned that the Hollywood treatment might actually do more harm than good. Diana Washington Valdez, whose voice we heard in the previous piece, is an El Paso Times reporter who worked the Juarez beat for almost 12 years. Diana, welcome to the show.
Yes, hello.
After all these years and all these deaths, it would seem that reporters covering this story would be delighted that the attention of Hollywood and the world were to be focused on this case. But you're not so thrilled necessarily, are you?
Hollywood, there's no question about it, has a lot of impact. And what some of us fear is that the viewers will go away with the wrong impression as to what was behind these murders. They will go away with the idea that the bus drivers did it. They were killing the women all these years, which is the official line. And so what could happen is that the truth will get lost in all this.
Now, you mentioned the bus drivers. Please describe that theory of the case and where it stands now.
Yes, the authorities have charged two sets of bus drivers in connection with some of these multiple homicides. And in both cases, there's been no scientific proof linking the bus drivers to these crimes. They were fabricated scapegoats, and a couple of them, in fact, have been released. And the real killers have not been brought to justice.
Now, you have a theory based on your extensive reporting over these past 13 years. Describe for me, please, what you believe has taken place.
There are several sets of killers that explain these murders. Two or more serial killers that have killed with impunity and are still loose. Low-level drug dealers that have killed and have gotten away with murder. Two violent gangs that have killed women as a way of initiating their members. A group of powerful men that have killed with impunity. And your copycats that have taken advantage of these scenarios to hide their own crimes. None of them are in jail. None of them have been prosecuted or apprehended. And what's more, the Mexican authorities know and have known all this time who's behind the murders. And instead of going after them, they've protected them.
Now, I've read of silver or lead threats made against Mexican journalists. That is to say, you can take money and be bribed off of the story, or we'll take care of it for you with violence. Have you had any silver or lead threats yourself?
I haven't gone there in about a year and a half. The most important threats, the ones that I responded to, were delivered to me personally in El Paso by someone conveying a message from police who are linked with the drug cartels. And basically the message was that if I ever went back to Ciudad Juarez, they had something prepared for me. I know when to stop, and I knew that day would come.
Let's get back to these new movies. Tell me about the two major films and where you believe they go wrong.
Well, what I know of the Minnie Driver movie is that basically it has a supernatural element to it that I think totally detracts from any kind of reality about the issue. I understand one of the central figures develops stigmata. What is that going to do? Turn this whole thing into a myth again, which is exactly what the authorities want. In the case of the Jennifer Lopez movie, Amnesty International representatives and others who have seen the script have told me that it just concludes that the bus drivers were behind these murders, which again is the official line. We don't make any progress, and a lot more people are going to go away with the wrong impression.
You know, in the best of all worlds, Hollywood focuses on this, which puts pressure on the Mexican government to get serious about the investigation with the eyes of the world upon it. Could that happen?
Yes, because there's no question that these movies will raise the visibility of this issue on such a level that will be very difficult for the governments to ignore. And also people out there will then be wanting to know, at least some of them, well, then this was Hollywood. This was the movie depiction. What is the real story here? Bringing attention to the issue is one thing. Forcing change is another. Or I think what needs to happen is this issue needs to be taken out of the hands of the Mexican government, and the whole thing needs to be taken before an international tribunal. And the international tribunal should be trying the presidents and the governors who were in power when these crimes occurred for failing to prosecute the killers and for failing to deliver justice.
Okay, Diana. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Diana Washington Valdez is a reporter for the El Paso Times and author of Harvest of the Women, which will be released in English this summer.
Thursday night, President Bush devoted an hour of his 60th birthday to a White House sit-down with a major news organization. It was a rare exercise for the president, who so mistrusts the media filter, he has substantially filtered the media out of his executive routine. But there he was, along with the First Lady, answering questions live to tape on CNN. A million or so viewers caught the broadcast. One of them was Bob.
Larry King? CNN gets an hour with the president and they send Larry King? In cowboy boots, no less. Okay, let's figure the White House wasn't going to let George Bush sit down with John King or Christiane Amanpour or Dr. Sanjay Gupta or anyone else more likely than Larry to hold presidential feet to the fire. So presuming this would be Larry King Live or no Bush exclusive at all, let's give one of broadcasting's most inveterate interviewers the benefit of the doubt. And sure enough, some of the questions were just the ones, say, I would have asked.
So there's no doubt, if you had to do it all over again, knowing that WMDs weren't there, you'd still go in. How well are we prepared if there's another Katrina? Are you optimistic that this Korean thing will be resolved?
Absolutely. I'm optimistic that all problems will be resolved.
The president, alas, wasn't especially revealing. So Larry challenged, interrupted, and repeated the questions relentlessly.
She told me it was not her decision. It was ABC's decision.
But I said...
She held it off for a while. They wanted to do it earlier. Is that true?
Oh, wait. That wasn't Thursday with the president. That was last week with Star Jones Reynolds about her firing from The View. No, with the president, Larry was as relentful as can be.
Al Gore was on recently on this program, and concerning the environment, he said, President Bush and Vice President Cheney have anointed to every key position that has anything to do with climate change, special interest spokesman for the oil companies, coal companies. And this is no secret. How do you respond to that? Have you seen his film?
No, I haven't seen it yet, but yeah, I guess politics never stops.
Politics, Larry? After the president stopped rambling about ethanol or whatever, couldn't he have brought up the Kyoto Treaty he won't sign? What about censoring NASA scientists who acknowledge global warming? Yeah, first questions are great, but journalism isn't about going down the list. It's about following up and getting answers. An hour with the president squandered this way is just so frustrating. The thing about a free press is either use it or lose it, a point made painfully clear when Larry raised the president's attack on the New York Times for informing the public about how private bank records are routinely tracked in the war on terror.
It doesn't make any sense to me to give the enemy... our game plan on how we're going to deal with them.
Isn't that a ticklish line, though, free press? I mean, you've got to support a free press.
I do support a free press strongly. I also want people to recognize that we're at war. And I just don't understand. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Laura, we asked emails, and one came in for you. I read that you were once a librarian.
Yes, Mrs. Bush. Do tell. Inquiring minds want to know.
Coming up, the life and legacy of the Freedom of Information Act on its 40th birthday.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In 1962, President Kennedy said, "A nation that is afraid to let its people judge the truth and falsehood in an open market is afraid of its people." In 1966, on the 4th of July, President Johnson signed the Freedom of Information Act that requires the government to release most official documents to anyone who requests them. But neither president welcomed FOIA. In fact, it had been gestating in the House for more than 11 years, and when it was finally ushered into existence 40 years ago this Tuesday, it was like any newborn, weak and toothless. In the mid-70s, largely in response to Watergate, the power of the act greatly expanded. But its strength has ebbed and flowed under the march of presidents, and George W. Bush, it's fair to say, counts as a definite ebb. Under Bush, and even before September 11th, former Attorney General John Ashcroft reversed the presumption to disclose under FOIA, and exemptions to the act have proliferated. In fact, the most important recent disclosures, such as documents related to torture at Abu Ghraib, were made only after long and costly lawsuits. So, now we'll review the life and legacy of the act, starting with Johnson in 1966. Bill Moyers was his press secretary, and he says the president was no different from any official on any level when it came to airing his laundry.
There was no exception in the Johnson administration. The president was not known for wanting to fling wide open the doors of the closet and say, come in, guys, and look around, see what you can find. In fact, in Congress, as a powerful Senate majority leader, he had kept his cards very close to his chest. He didn't want his options to be disclosed. He didn't want his friends or his adversaries to know what he was up to, and he carried that penchant for secrecy into the White House. But there had been a long struggle by a handful, relative handful, of newspaper editors and a few members of Congress to pass this act. And the pressure grew until the president found it impossible to resist any further because he needed too many of these editors to try to help him tell his side of the story about his Great Society legislation, the war in Vietnam. But he had to be dragged screaming to that signing ceremony in 1966. In fact, privately, he used language that I cannot use on National Public Radio.
Sure you can.
No, I can't use it.
Well, as you say, he was dragged kicking and screaming to sign it. But did he, deep down, do you think, believe in it, or was he opposed to what it stood for?
I think he was opposed to what it stood for. I mean, I don't think I've known any president who believed that the press should have, that the public should have this kind of untrammeled access to the secrets of government. John F. Kennedy, before Johnson, had been adamantly opposed to the Freedom of Information Act. He had lectured members of the press often about their obligations in a time of national security, the height of the Cold War, to go along with the government. But this bill would not have passed except for the work of an amazing member of Congress from California, John Moss.
What did this congressman from the 3rd Congressional District of California have that you guys so close to the president didn't? Who is this man, John Moss?
Well, I didn't know much about him at the time, except that he had been elected at a very young age, and he'd found it frustrating as a young member of Congress to get the information from the executive branch that he needed to function more efficiently as a congressman. And he felt one of the chief beneficiaries of the Freedom of Information Act would be Congress itself. And he was relentless. He was a bulldog about it. How does a member of Congress come to this obsession with an issue like this? There was no great public clamor for it. There were no Gallup polls that showed this would have catapulted him into some spotlight of public acceptance. In fact, he said that cooperation between the Johnson White House and the Congress had been excellent, unprecedented, he said. But despite this, he said, you know, we still have to have this principle enshrined in legislation.
Bill Moyers, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Bill Moyers. His current PBS series, Bill Moyers on Faith and Reason, airs on Friday nights. John Moss, who first said sunlight is the best disinfectant, served in Congress from 1953 until 1978. Frank Silby went to work for him in 72. And he says Moss's passion made him an irresistible force.
Well, he was a stormy petrel in a lot of ways. He had a temper, and he had a very strong sense of ethics. Ralph Nader once called him the best single member of the House. As a result of the respect he had earned in the private sector and in the government, and among Republicans and conservatives, as well as Democrats and liberals, he could muster enough political clout to strengthen the law and to prevent attempts to weaken it.
Now, as this legislation was being drawn up in 1966, was Mr. Moss aware, were you all aware, that it still lacked teeth?
Yes.
That in the 70s, you were going to have to go back and make it stronger?
Absolutely. And in fact, he always spoke about that. And he was always unhappy over the number of exceptions to the law behind which people who had something to hide could conceal documentation.
So John Moss was a leader in oversight and investigation, and that's where you came in. What precisely was your job?
I was his chief of investigations, if you will. The guys that I worked with were, many of them, head and shoulders above me. They had courage because oversight is a thankless persuasion. You're kicking sacred cows. You're offending other members because you're looking at the programs that they have a vested interest in concealing any abuses that afflict them. It's confrontational. It's occasionally ugly. But the results can be magnificent in the public interest. And Mr. Moss was key because you're only as good as the willingness of your chairman to back you up. I had no real power except through him. People would come to me, whistleblowers, and bootleg documents to me, and I would show them to the chairman. We would then demand other documents. We would subpoena them if necessary. Then that we would hold hearings, and those hearings were extremely powerful because we had a working relationship with most investigative reporters in Washington. There are scandals galore in these federal agencies. They're lying around like stones on a beach, but there isn't a John Moss around with a team of probers and investigators who can lateral off to some great investigative reporters that can blow these stories.
So now it's 40 years after the bill has passed, and we know the strength of FOIA ebbs and flows with the times and with the various administrations, but it still works as a basic tool, right?
Yes, it does. In fact, it works even on a local level. I have a home in Palm Beach, Florida. There is a coalition of community groups. Their development is, of course, a major issue down here. And these people think that the city fathers are too favorable to too much growth. And they want to ask questions. And so far, the city has not been forthcoming. I advised them on a pro bono basis. And I told them about the Freedom of Information Act. And like Paul on the road to Damascus, lo and behold, they have seen a great and blinding light. And in this case, they're starting to write these letters. And all of a sudden, there is discomfiture at City Hall.
Are you saying they got the information they requested through FOIA?
They're starting to get it. They haven't gotten all of it, but they're starting to use their opposition through FOIA in a more effective fashion. This law applies on every level. It is about as critical to a democracy as anything else I can think of, the right to find out what your government is doing in your name and with your resources. That really is everything that it is all about. And that understanding of what our institutions are and what our rights are will make a new generation rise in defense of those rights, embodied in part by the Freedom of Information Act and the example that Mr. Moss set. Maybe I'm dreaming, but I'm still an optimist.
All right. Thank you very much.
It was my pleasure, miss.
Frank Silby serves on the board of the John E. Moss Foundation and runs two companies specializing in congressional and federal investigations. FOIA may be a useful tool, but it can be hard to master. The National Security Archive, an independent governmental research institute, has filed tens of thousands of FOIA requests, so we challenge the NSA's Barbara Elias to tell us how to do it in 2 minutes or less.
The government agency is not going to care why you want the material. In fact, if they do care why you want the material, then you should be concerned. You do need to explain a little bit about who you are just so they can categorize you as far as fees are concerned. Clarify if you are a graduate student and therefore you are eligible for an educational requester status, or if you are a member of the news media and therefore deserve that processing fee. Most people, most average citizen, will fall into what's called the all other category. And that gives you 2 hours free search and review time and 100 pages free. So usually your request, as long as it's under 100 pages, will be processed without charge. You want to limit how much paper you're asking for, because the more you ask for, the longer it's going to take. For example, asking the Pentagon for all documents they have on Abu Ghraib is an unreasonably large request. I mean, that's just not a request that they could process. So find out exactly the name of a report on Abu Ghraib that you're interested in. Ask for that. A part of that, too, is understanding which agency is going to control the documents that you're asking for. The Department of Defense cannot release State Department material. You need to go directly to the State Department. Once you've submitted your request, delay is inevitable, especially if you're asking for documents that require any kind of declassification review. So sometimes frequently, in fact, the FOIA officer at the agency can be your best friend in this process. And I think it's really important to call them and to really, you know, negotiate the request with them to say, what are the stumbling blocks on it, because this really seems reasonable to me. What is your perspective on it? If the documents are excised or if they've been withheld, you can file an appeal, which will kick the review up to a higher level in the government agency, so you'll have more senior people reviewing your material.
1 minute and 53 seconds. Not bad. Barbara Elias is the Freedom of Information Coordinator at the National Security Archive. What she didn't have time to say is that increasingly groups like hers resort to lawsuits. Right now, the National Security Archive is suing the CIA over a change in how it processes FOIA requests. Over the years, government recalcitrance over FOIA has prompted David Vladek to sue many, many times. He teaches at the Georgetown University Law Center, and he says FOIA was always meant to be a battleground.
Everybody recognized that the bill was far from perfect, that it was more aspirational than enforceable, but it was an important step forward towards an open society. The most important amendment to FOIA came on the heels of Watergate. Congress passed a sweeping overhaul of FOIA that transformed essentially a paper tiger into one with real teeth. The 1974 amendments imposed enforceable time limits. Prior to 74, agencies took whatever time they wanted to respond. The statute was amended to permit judges to review national security records, law enforcement records, to oversee agency determinations about secrecy. I could go on and on, but the 1974 amendments were truly transformative.
So then where are we in the battle today? I mean, you talk about a 1970s provision that imposed some time limits on responding to these requests. And we've read that the Justice Department now has a median response time for complex requests of up to 863 days, according to a report by the Coalition of Journalists for Open Government. So is this time limit provision imposed in the 70s still being respected?
No, and I would make no pretense otherwise, but FOIA is still a crucial tool. We just filed on behalf of researchers a number of requests trying to get access to United States policy regarding methods of interrogation that might be deemed to constitute torture.
Mm-hmm.
We filed that request 10 days ago. We've already gotten preliminary responses from two agencies. Now, several of the other agencies may take weeks, may take months, may take even years, though, of course, we'll sue them before then. But you've identified a real problem. For journalists particularly who are writing on deadline, delays of the kind that you've just discussed make it difficult, if not impossible, to use FOIA as the tool it was envisioned to be, which is the principal way people have a window into what their government is doing.
You can say it's still an effective tool, but for somebody who isn't absolutely expert like yourself, how effective really is it?
Well, I think that one of the realities is you have an administration that's dead set against implementation of FOIA. If no other legacy is affixed to President Bush, he will go down as the secrecy president. The first act of John Ashcroft was to issue a memo rescinding prior memos from the Clinton administration, and the Ashcroft memo made it clear that agencies should withhold rather than disclose information provided that there was any arguable legal basis to do so. And agency heads quickly got that message. Since this administration has taken office, I've had to litigate cases that would never have been brought under previous administrations. I can give you a laundry list if you'd like, but time and again, we've had to go into court to get access to information that is plainly non-exempt under FOIA, but the government fights anyway. There's also been a change in the courts. The courts through the maybe mid-1990s were committed to the philosophy of FOIA. But as more and more conservative judges take the bench, you've seen, I think, a judicial pushback.
Are the courts the only place we have available to us?
I think at this point in time, the courts are really the only forum to which the public can turn. The courts still do step in and correct the most egregious abuses. Last week, for example, we won an important decision out of the United States Court for the District of Columbia Circuit. That court ruled that the Department of Agriculture could not withhold records demonstrating the extent to which senior department officials met with representatives of the meat and poultry industry during the course of weakening an important rule to protect the public from a foodborne illness caused by the Listeria bacteria. And the court said, essentially, and this was a mixed panel, these were two Republican-appointed judges, one Democrat, the court unanimously said the agency had gone too far. They could not conduct their business in the back room, that the American public had a right to know the extent to which the industry was involved in this rulemaking.
One last question. Prior to 1966, when FOIA was written into law, was there nothing on the books to give Americans some right to access information?
The answer is not really. In 1947, Congress passed the Administrative Procedure Act, which gave a very limited, essentially unenforceable right to certain agency records. And there was always a common law understanding that certain government records might be publicly available. But the reason why July 4th, 1966 should be an important date in American history is because that marks the first time we as a nation engaged in a collective act to say that transparency in government, openness in government, is a value we as Americans care about.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
David Vladek specializes in open government litigation and teaches at Georgetown University Law Center. To conclude, here's a bit of a song by attorney Dan Clow, a tribute to FOIA that we took off the internet. Fair use.
In the wake of Watergate and the president's demise, the people knew that time had come to make a change. For the government to have a soul, it's got to live in a fishing bowl under the constant gaze of the people and the Fourth Estate. The legislature heard the people.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had engineering help from Rob Christensen and other assistants from Claire Peters and Noah Kuman. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by Ciaobella Gelato, purveyors of all natural gelato and sorbet. Ciaobella is available nationwide at specialty food markets. More information at ciaobellagelato.com or 1-800-GELATO-3. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org. And thanks.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.